So this sentence that I started my write-up with in the E-News was, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Columbus." And as we start our exploration of, in the Buddha's words, I was really drawn to this third section of the book, which is called Approaching the Dhamma. How is it that we come to these teachings? And once we've come to the teachings, how is it that we hear them? How is it that we take them in? And how is it that we implement them in our lives? And some of the other sections talk a lot more about implementing them in our lives. But this section, I thought it was important to start from there, because if we don't understand the filter that we're receiving the teachings through, and we've all got filters, whether we're aware of them or not, we're not going to get the most out of the teachings. We're going to be limited by our vision, by our past experiences, by our reactivity, whatever it might be. I mean, there are people that are reactive to the book. You know, it's like, oh, it's a holy book. I'm not going to read that. You know? Well, the solution was get it in electronic format. And it doesn't seem so much like a Bible. Right? Great solution. So we all walk around with our own prejudices, our own limitations, and our own mental formations, they're called. And these poor people from Kesaputta, called the Kalamas, it's often joked that they were in the Marin County of 2,500 years ago. And I can make that joke because I grew up in Marin County. So apparently, if you read the notes, this town was like on the edge of a forest, and there was a crossing of a river. It was on the edge of a forest, and so all the teachers that came didn't want to go through there at night. So if they get there like late in the afternoon, they just stay there for the night, and then, hey, I'm here, I might as well give some teachings. So every teacher that was wandering through that part of India would give some teachings. And they would not all be in agreement with each other. Let's put it that way. So Bhikkhu Bodhi likens that to our current day when, as he puts it, any earnest, open-minded spiritual seeker is in a distressing predicament. And he's usually pretty understated, but every once in a while he comes out with these zingers. Distressing predicament in choosing which teachings to follow. So, you know, in this day and age, I mean, we not only have multiple ways of approaching life, we have humanist ways of approaching life, we have spiritual ways of approaching life. If you decide to take a spiritual path, you've got Western ways of approaching spirituality, you've got Eastern ways of approaching spirituality. If you want to do the Eastern way, even in Sacramento, you've got your choice of the Vietnamese Buddhist temple, the Sikh temple, the Hindu temple, multiple ethnic Buddhist temples that are available to you. You have secular Western practitioners. If you're a secular Western practitioner, you can choose Tibetan, Zen, our tradition, Insight Vipassana. It's overwhelming. And where do you start? For some reason, you're all here, either tonight or some of you longer term and some of you much longer term. And I think it's important in hearing the teachings to ask yourself, why? Why do I resonate with this tradition? What is it about this particular tradition that brought me to it, and it keeps me here? Bhikkhu Bodhi points out that when there are multiple systems floating around for us to choose from, the easy road is just to say, oh, they're all the same. All paths lead up the mountain, and you know, once you get to the mountain, it's all the same, so all paths are equal. His point of view, which I'll just present here without consciously making a choice of whether I believe it or not. I'm sure my unconscious opinion will come through somehow, but his opinion is that that is not really valid, because deep down, if you get deep enough into each of these traditions, the differences start to show up. The difference in the basic assumptions, the differences in how we might approach this life, the differences in whether there is a next life or not, all of that. So, you know, it's quite easy to stay on the surface of things and say, well, everything is the same. All these traditions are exactly the same. But when we get to the level of deciding how to practice and what to actually implement in our lives, the differences start to show up. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's point, and this part I agree with strongly, is that most spiritual systems at the outset demand some sort of leap of faith, some sort of acceptance of something that is not verifiable in our personal experience. And what makes Buddhism and the Buddhist teaching specifically unique is that at the outset, and we'll have a discussion later on of whether how long that outset lasts, but at the outset, there's no requirement for believing anything. That ultimately, in the beginning, we can rely on direct experience to inform us as to whether the teachings are working or not, whether they're worth accepting or not. Now, his point of view is that ultimately, again, farther down the road, there are some teachings that cannot be fully validated from our personal experience in this lifetime. And as Diane pointed out well last week, Bhikkhu Bodhi is representing a very orthodox Theravadan monk point of view on these teachings. So from that point of view, there are experiences, there are things at work that may not be evident to us and that may not be testable in our personal experience. And we can talk about that again a little bit more in a bit. But he says that we can start on the path without, quote, placing faith in doctrines that lie beyond the range of our immediate experience, unquote. And I think most of us that have come to this practice have kind of felt that way about it, that it hasn't been required a lot of leaps of faith just to enter the practice. Now, we can ask ourselves, okay, we can rely on direct experience, but direct experience of what? Is it like a squishy, touchy-feely feeling that, oh, when we sit in a room with this many people, we feel a positive energy, and that proves that the teachings are right? Well, maybe, but Bhikkhu Bodhi's point is that there's a very concrete test in our personal experience of whether the teachings work or not. And not surprisingly, since it was the core of the Buddhist teaching, the test is, are we suffering or are we not suffering? Since the teaching is about suffering and the end of suffering, or to be stated in the positive, about happiness and its causes, we can actually use our experience as we apply these teachings to see which way it points our minds, which way it points our lives. Does it point it toward suffering? Does it point it away from suffering? Does it point it toward happiness? Does it point it away from happiness? That's the test of direct experience that Bhikkhu Bodhi is talking about in his introduction to this section. He also uses a phrase, he says we can use our experience, and he uses another phrase, intelligent observation. So Sayadaw Utejaneya, who's a Burmese monk, often talks about we get knowledge and information and wisdom in three different ways. There's the what he calls suttamaya panya, which is the acquisition of knowledge from others. It's secondhand. We hear someone give a talk. We hear someone give a teaching. We read a book. All of those are outside information that we're taking in and learning from. That's suttamaya panya. Chintamaya panya is actually using the mind, what Bhikkhu Bodhi calls intelligent observation. It's using our cognitive abilities, which sometimes we tend to kind of play down a little bit in this tradition. But no one has asked you to check your mind at the door when you come into a meditation hall in the insider Vipassana tradition. It's actually our intelligence is what we use to discern the fact that one thing is different from another. You know, the way that we can tell if the result of an action is causing us to suffer or not suffer is by actually watching the result and intelligently observing how does that feel in the mind and body? How does that affect people around me? All of these things are, I mean, yes, they're experience, but they're also intelligent observation. It's actually using our cognitive powers to interpret what's going on. So that's the second way we acquire knowledge. The third one is called bhavanamaya panya, and you might recognize bhavana. It's the same word as meditation. It's cultivation. It comes from the agricultural term in the Buddhist time of actually, you know, plowing up the field, actually doing the work. And so it's meditation. It's that intuitive insight that we talk about a lot more here. So those are the three ways we acquire knowledge. Now, I kind of think of them in a way as being information. The suttamaya panya is information that we're getting from listening to a talk or hearing a teacher or reading a book or something like that. Knowledge, which is using the mind, and then wisdom. And so we are acquiring, and all of these are necessary. They all build on each other. We may think of intuitive insight as something that just pops up out of nowhere, out of the blue, with no precedent, no cause, no condition, but that's not, everything is a result of causes and conditions in this tradition. So any kind of knowledge that we obtain, any kind of reading that we do, any kind of Dharma discussions that we have with each other, any kind of talks that you might listen to online, all of that is building a background that can inform your own intelligent observation and that can later result in your own intuitive insight arising. So these things all work together. So let's just open it up a little bit. We're going to move on to the sutta next, to the Kama Sutta. And I realized in preparing for tonight, there's no way we're going to finish all this tonight. First of all, the sutta itself is really rich. There's at least three sections that I want to talk about, whether we'll get to them tonight or not. But I want to leave it open for a future talk. And then unless Diane or Dennis really wants to approach some of the other suttas in this section 3, I may stay with this approaching the Dhamma section for several weeks. So for sure, August 3rd, my next talk, we will talk again about the Kalama Sutta and certainly about section 3. So I'll see how it goes tonight before I do my write-up about assigning further reading. But those of you that just picked up the books tonight, don't worry, you have some chance to read them between now and later.
Should there be some things that we're reading right now in preparation for?
Yeah, the reading I gave for tonight was pages 81 to 85 of the introduction, and then the first and second suttas. The first one's just that paragraph about the secret teaching, there are no secret teachings, and then the second one is the Kalama Sutta.
So that's all from 81
85 and then 89 to 91, I think. 88 to 91. And for those of you that do have an electronic version of it, it's not easy to line the pages up. So, but as I mentioned last time, the way Bhikkhu Bodhi does his introductions is that he sort of gives a bunch of general paragraphs, and then he goes one by one in order through the sutta selections that he has coming up in that section. So if you're reading from an electronic version, read the part of the introduction that takes you through the discussion of the first and second suttas. So when it starts on Roman numeral 3, number 3, that's the third sutta. We, you know, that's not the part that we read for tonight. Okay. So before moving on to the Kalama Sutta, I'd like to hear from folks that a little bit about your own search. I mean, you know, this earnest, open-minded spiritual seeker sort of struck a chord with me. It sounded very familiar. You know, I'd have to think about it, but the way that I ended up coming to this set of teaching was a really kind of an accident. I mean, I wasn't out there, you know, being completely torn apart by suffering and just desperately looking for any way out. I mean, I actually was on this, I have been on, in my whole life, on this spiritual search, and it just happened to be that these teachings came along at a time that resonated with me in my life. But I'd like to hear from others how you resonate with this idea of these poor Kalamas, you know, sitting at this forest edge and hearing all these teachers come by, and maybe some of your experience with hearing some other teachings and, you know, making either a conscious or accidental decision to show up here, and maybe what brought you here, or what's keeping you here, anything along those lines. Anything resonate out of what you've heard tonight or read? Anyone ever been in a distressing predicament?
Well, Sarah, I've shared this before, but I have done a lot of different things in my life along my spiritual path, but I actually came to this particular organization because, or this form of practice, because I went to an event that was a monologue of by somebody, and the whole hour and a half, whatever it was a woman sitting in retreat, felt like dialoguing on what was going on in her mind.
And that didn't scare you off. That didn't scare you off.
No, actually, it totally intrigued me. She was in the program with her boyfriend, and she had all these things going on in her life, and she was supposedly in some remote location, you know, in a tent, and she sat there. And she went through all these emotions and all these thoughts and all these, you know, mental discussions within herself. And I was so, first of all, I was like, oh my God, there's people that have, like that's me. You know, I just could really relate to it. And I thought, oh, the idea of going on retreat for a long time would really appeal to me. And Dennis was the one who was introducing this. And so I talked to him afterwards and thought, oh, I think I could learn something from this, you know. And then I went off and did my life for several more years until I think one of my staff took the beginning class and told me about it, and so I connected with the next beginning class and started becoming and then got involved, and it was over 10 years ago. But it was that evening of listening to that person and sort of listening to the description of all the things that came up in my mind and sort of watching how she evolved over the retreat. And it kind of gave me hope, you know, like, oh, you know, you can learn to be more skillful with your life and with everything going on inside of you.
Great, thank you. Could everybody hear that? Yeah, she's just saying that one of the events that kind of brought her to this practice was listening to a person give a dialogue a woman give a dialogue of actually what was going on in her head in the course of a retreat, of a residential retreat, and realizing, hey, you know, actually this mind can be understood and worked with, and things can get better.
My personal experience in just to cultivate the culmination of this life events of raising kids, and finances, and stress at work, just all of a sudden started making just functioning on a daily basis very difficult. I just all of a sudden just kind of looked around and realized I'm feeling overwhelmed, and that prompted me to take a stress reduction class, which techniques of which fascinated me and were very effective and spurred me to find out where these techniques came from. And they did a very good job of staying away from proselytizing, but I eventually cornered them and got it out of them. And that led me to do some more searching, like at Spirit Rock, and going further into studying what the Buddha was actually saying, and the suffering and the causes of suffering, which were just very poignant, and the techniques of reconnecting with myself, with my body, being able to observe my mind, and feeling the effects, some of which were almost immediate, this works.
Thank you.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, and his nutshell in a nutshell was that taking a stress reduction course and actually finding out where those techniques came from, because they're really working, finding out they came from these teachings, and then going on to follow up at Spirit Rock and more practice.
That was in contradistinction to the practice I was given as a child.
Oh.
Protestant Christianity. So that was another aspect of my journey. What I'd been given and tried to use my whole life
wasn't helping. Yeah, good. That's a good point to bring up here. That, I mean, when we talk about spiritual traditions, you know, many of us, we're steeped in various other spiritual traditions. And I think most of us in here are convert Buddhists. I mean, not that you have to be a Buddhist, but I'm just saying you've come to this generally from either nothing or from another, usually Western religion. So there's that at play as well.
I got into recovery in 1988, and although the program, as I was supposedly spiritual and not religious, it seemed very religious to me. A lot of God, and Abrahamic Christian emphasis, I thought. But part of it was on meditation. So I started meditating on my own, had no idea what I was doing. And then in the early 90s, I picked up a couple of books, Thich Nhat Hanh, things like that. And then like 10 years ago, a friend of mine got into Bhante Ji's book, Meditation Plain English, I read it. It's made a lot of sense to me. So I started coming to Sam when I wasn't out of state working, and just got into it a little more and realized this is a really good, really, really good path for me. Because like the Buddha says, you know, it's like if it works for you, don't take it on face value. It has to work for you for it to work. And I like that aspect of it. And there's aspects of it that I'm not so sure about, and I know that's okay. We're free to believe what we want to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll explore that territory a lot more. That's what this sutta is about. So, thank you. Anyone else? Yes?
What drew me to teaching Buddha was when I wanted to learn meditation, I sat in on a Dharma talk, and I fell in love with the community and feeling completely safe, and then I saw that I trusted what the teacher was saying, and that began my journey there.
Great, thank you. So going from community to the teacher to the teachings, right? And the feeling of safety.
I felt really safe, like that no one was ever going to hurt me.
Right.
And I've never felt that outside for the Sangha. It was just, it was nice. It was a really nice feeling. I just knew and trusted that the people that were sitting next to me that first night of learning about the Buddha, that no one was going to hurt me there.
Yeah. So you've got refuge in all three of the jewels right there.
Lucky me.
Yeah, lucky you. Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, well, let's dip into the sutta then. First of all, I don't know if you remember, but last time I talked, I said, oh, the Kalama Sutta is not in here. And what had happened was, as I was reviewing the list, there's an index in the back here, of index of Pali Sutta titles, and the Kalama Sutta is actually not an official title of this. In fact, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, and a lot of the Anguttara Nikaya suttas don't have official Pali titles. So I misspoke when I said it wasn't in here. It's in here, but it does, the Kalama Sutta is sort of a common name for it. And it's not in the index. Popularly known as the Kalama Sutta is what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. So when this sutta starts off, you know, a lot of the suttas, when they start off, they have this formulaic thing. Oh, that's what I heard. I was at whatever town it might be, you know, Kesaputta in this case, or it might say Savatthi, or it might say Kapilavatthu, or wherever it might be. And it'll say they were in this town with so many monks, and then people came up, and they always go up to the Buddha, and they do something, and then they go off to one side. And then they ask their questions, and then he plays off their questions. This is very unusual. This particular one is very unusual in that all of these Kalamas go up and they actually do four different things. They, you know, like when the monks come up, they always go up, they pay homage, and they sit to one side. These pay homage. They bow reverentially. They're silent. Some of them are silent. They come up, they're silent, they sit to one side. And then some of them go up and exchange greetings and cordial talk. This is a message that these are not disciples of the Buddha. That's how I take it. The greetings and cordial talk, if you go through and try to find another sutta that says the Buddha was up there in front and a bunch of people came up and did greetings and cordial talk with him, you're not going to find it. Except for like other wandering ascetics, or like a Brahmin, every once in a while will exchange some greetings and cordial talk. And often it's not the Buddha, it's like when Sariputta's given a talk, or Ananda. So this tells us right away that this is a little bit different, that the audience is a little bit different than the usual audience of 500 monks, and, you know, 500 means a lot, by the way. It doesn't mean literally 500. So that was the first thing I noticed about this sutta that was a little bit different. Is that these at the very beginning they kind of break up into four different groups, and they kind of approach him in four different ways. And so they start to describe how difficult it is to live in this town where all these teachers are coming through. And they say that these teachers come through, and yeah, they promote their own teaching, but they also disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. So it's confusing enough when someone says, here's what I believe, why don't you try believing that too? But when someone comes in 1 week and says, the sky is blue, and then someone comes in the next week and said, the sky is red, and oh, by the way, anybody that says the sky is blue is insane. And then a week after that, someone says, the guy's purple. And anybody that says it's blue or red, forget it. They don't know what they're talking about. One could get very, very confused. So this is what was happening. Was not only were people coming in and just offering freely their teachings, but they were expending energy disparaging, debunking, reviling, and vilifying the doctrines of others. So you can understand why these poor Kalamas were really confused. So the Buddha gave this formula, and it's very well known. And I think we've all heard it, not to rely on 10 sources of belief for deciding whether to follow a teaching or not. And Bhikkhu Bodhi breaks it down. Four of them are based on scriptural authority. Four of them are based on rational approaches. So the India of this time had a very finely developed philosophical tradition. So there are these very finely divided rational approaches to teachings that one might use. And then two of them are based on the authority of the person itself who is talking. So you've probably heard this before, but let's just go over it again. Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts. So those are the four scriptural authority ones. By logic, inferential reasoning, reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it. Those are the four rational philosophical ones. The seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the aesthetic, this teacher, is our teacher. Now, I don't know about you, but I listened to that list, and I've used a lot of those to decide whether I believe something or not. You know? The charisma, the seeming competence of the teacher, oral tradition, you know, the fact that something's been around for 2,500 years gives me a little bit more confidence that it's probably true than if someone made it up in 1988, right? I don't know about the logical ones, but I mean, think about it. You know, science is the new religion in the West, and so we're often quite reluctant to accept anything that doesn't fit one of those four methods of, you know, either reasoning it through or just sort of pondering it, thinking about it, and then deciding, well, okay, I guess that's all right. So I've used many of those. And so when I looked at that list, you know, often when we hear don't do this and don't do that and don't do that, we think, oh yeah, I would never do that. But then when you look closely at them and you get beyond the actual words, have you ever used any of these? You know, the fact that it's an ancient oral tradition, the fact that there's a lineage of teaching, the fact that you hearsay, in other words, someone says to you, oh, the Buddha said, and you accept that without finding out for yourself if the Buddha actually said that or not. By the way, you can do that with fakebuddhaquote.com. Great site. It doesn't just tell you why it's fake, it tells you why it's fake. I mean, it doesn't tell you that it's fake, it tells you why it's fake and what the real one that might have been similar. You ever believed anything just because it was part of a big collection of texts? Like maybe the Pali Canon? Logic, inferential reasoning, reason, cogitation, acceptance of a view after pondering it. You ever use that one? The seeming competence or a teacher, or, hey, this person's my teacher. So, you know, maybe you've been following a teacher for a while and, you know, you kind of agree with most of what they say, and then they come out with something sometime and you're like, where'd they come up with that? But then you think, oh, well, they're my teacher. I guess it's true. Anybody ever done that? So do any of these sound familiar? I mean, is it possible that any of us have used any of these? So, you know, I think when we first read this sutta, we think, oh, well, that applies to other things other than the teachings of the Buddha. Because, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, are just they're just self-evident. I mean, you just hear them once and they instantly penetrate and, you know. But honestly, I mean, when I sat down and honestly looked through this list and evaluated my own experience with the teachings and the people that I've acquired them from, how have I acquired them? Well, hearsay, reading books, not necessarily the primary text. I do not read Pali. You know, and as we know, the Buddha did not speak Pali. So even if you're reading Pali, you're reading hearsay. You're reading a secondhand version of it, right? That Ananda, if we believe the legend, Ananda recited at the first Buddhist Congress, and then all those monks memorized it, and then they passed it down, oh, by the way, by oral tradition. And then some hundreds of years later, it was written down. Every one of us in this room has used one or more of these strategies that the Buddha is telling us not to use to acquire the knowledge that we have. Not only of Buddhist teachings, but of any other traditions you may have followed in your life. So that's worth thinking about. That's worth acknowledging that, okay, here the Buddha is, and you know, we often just sort of flippantly throw out, oh, well, yeah, the Buddha said don't just take it on faith, you know, test it in your own experience. But when I really examined in my own life if I've ever used any of these, yes, I have. I've used a lot of these. It's not to say I've never used my own personal experience. It's not to say that I haven't done unskillful things and resulted in my suffering and those of others, and I learned from that. Of course I have. But my point is, it's very easy to just write these off as applying to somebody else or to some other tradition. And be very careful when you do that. Be open to the possibility that maybe at any given moment we're using one or more of these strategies to evaluate whether we're accepting a teaching or not. Does that make sense? Did I insult anybody by pointing that out? So, moving on to the direct experience. So the Buddha goes on to talk about greed, hate, and delusion, right? I think that's actually how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates them in this particular sutta, greed, hatred, and delusion, which are the three fires or the three roots, the three poisons in the Mahayana tradition. They are the roots of all unskillful behavior. And it's very interesting what he says after that. He says, if you act on that and you allow yourself, your thoughts to be controlled by those three, here's what you're going to do. You're going to destroy life. You're going to take what is not given. You're going to engage in sexual misconduct. And you're going to tell lies. Bhikkhu Bodhi doesn't beat around the bush. That's how he translates it. You're going to tell lies. Does that list sound familiar to anybody? What is that? Yeah, those are the first four of the precepts, right? And they're often the first four are given. The one about intoxicant is sometimes not included in the list. It's often discussed separately, but it doesn't show up in the sutta. And then what to say about those things? Those lead to harm and suffering. I think we all know those lead to harm and suffering, right? And then, you know, as usual, they give the opposite formula. So if your thoughts are not controlled by these three roots, it will manifest as abstaining from all of those things. And in both cases, in the case of the unskillful behavior, when you're doing all those, violating all those four precepts, or in the case of when you're actually abstaining from all of those things and you're engaging in skillful behavior, the Buddha says, you will know these things for yourselves and you will prompt others. He's not just talking about the skillful behavior. He's saying when you're out there destroying life, taking what is not given, engaging in sexual misconduct, and telling lies, you are prompting others to do the same thing. That's suffering. That is suffering. And when we're doing that, I think it doesn't take a whole lot of self-awareness to feel the suffering in that. You know, certainly in our own behavior, but also if we're causing other people to do unskillful things, we feel that. You know, we know what that feels like. I know what that feels like in my life. I don't know about the rest of you. But if we're doing things and we're, you know, maybe not directly saying, hey, you know, you really should tell a lie to cover up for that thing I did the other day. But we're saying, you know, we're asking people to go along with us or whatever it might be. And if they end up telling a lie on our behalf, we're going to feel that, you know. That's a pain. There's a pain in that that's even greater than the harm that we're causing ourselves by our bad behavior. So what the Buddha is saying here, and I've never heard it in quite this way in any other place before, is that when you do skillful behaviors, you're not only knowing that for yourselves, the benefits of skillful behavior, but you're prompting others. When you're doing unskillful behaviors, you're not only knowing that suffering for yourself, but you're prompting others to suffer. You're actually causing others to suffer. You're prompting others to behave in a way that will cause suffering to them and to the others around them. So the unskillful behaviors lead to harm and suffering. The skillful behaviors lead to welfare and happiness. And this is the test. Bhikkhu Bodhi says in the introduction, this is the test. This is the direct experience that we're talking about. Is actually knowing the pain of that. The pain of breaking the precepts, if you want to put it in those terms. But the pain of generally unskillful behavior, knowing the pain of that, seeing your effect on other people, feeling the pain of that, and knowing how that feels, and learning from that, that's the direct experience that we're talking about. That is how we evaluate whether a teaching is worthwhile or not. Whether it's the Buddha's teachings or somebody else's teachings. You know, if somebody else says, love your neighbor as yourself, and you give that a shot, okay, how did that turn out for you? You know? If somebody else says, we're number one, let's act on that. Let's make ourselves great again, step on someone else to get there. Act on that and see how it feels. You can learn from direct experience from any teachings, not just from these teachings. The Buddha recommended it for his teachings, but you can learn from any teachings using this test. Acting skillfully leads to welfare and happiness. Acting unskillfully, harm and suffering. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to get dangerously close to karma and rebirth if we move on, so I'm going to stop right there. Questions, comments, thoughts, recommendations for next time? Yes?
You know, when I first heard that, I was really relieved because in the teachings, when I first started studying, hearing that the Buddha said women should not ordain, women should not become nuns, he had to be asked three times by Ananda for women to become part of the monastic sangha, and I remember feeling so disappointed, saying, this is an enlightened being, and he's saying half of the world is not worthy of being monastic. And it really caused some doubt. But this sutta, you know, with your own experience and what are you experiencing, was so helpful. What causes suffering and what alleviates suffering? I realized, I don't know if he actually said that. Was that, as Tony Bernhardt said, is it cranky monks who were editing the Pali Canon many years ago? So I don't have to believe that. I can go on my own experience.
Right.
And I'm so glad you brought up the second part, because so often we hear, go by, not by the teachings, not by a teacher, go by your own experience. But what's left out, what causes suffering,
right,
and what alleviates suffering.
Right.
And I think that's the most important part of that sutta.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, and to get back to your first point, let's look at excluding half of humanity from the monastic life. Does that lead to welfare and happiness, or does that lead to harm and suffering?
depends on who you ask, I guess. If you ask all the monks that are...
Yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi is one of the ones that appears to me to be on the wrong side of history, but we have a lot of other very, very skillful monks like Anālayo and Ajahn Brahm that are saying, no, that isn't what the Buddha intended. So.
Well, when I heard that same thing about that women couldn't ordain, and what came up for me was the teachings of the Buddha, and what initially drew me in, there is such immense kindness in them. If you try to follow the precepts, it's just a guidebook for treating others with kindness. And I thought, no, someone who taught that kind of kindness didn't make that kind of judgment about any living being or category of living being. So that was how I sorted out that one.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, let's give some props to Mahapajapati, huh? And she's the one that asked three times, you know. I mean, Ananda's the one that passed on the message, but she's the one that had the Sambhaga.
The Buddha's stepmother?
Yeah.
Mahapajapati.
Right. His aunt, the stepmother. And actually, she's the one that had the spiritual urgency, the Sambhaga, to say, I don't care if it's against the rules. I want to be ordained. And I want my sisters to be ordained. So.
She persisted.
Nevertheless, she persisted. Any other comments, questions, things to look for next time? Yes?
When you sent us a link on other suttas to look at if we didn't have the book yet?
Same sutta, but different translation. That's right.
But they were talking about nutriment in there, and I wondered if, since you sent that link, in, what they were saying in there, if you're going to just discuss that at some point.
That's next time.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get into that. But yeah, the one link I sent in the e-news was a link to an essay by Bhikkhu Bodhi that says a lot of the same things that he says in his introduction here. And then the other one was a translation by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who's another very traditional Theravada monk, but also a very good translator, that of this same sutta.
And they didn't, they put the three dots and didn't tell what the things were. So
dot,
I
dot, dot, yeah.
Some from one list and some from the other, but I didn't come away from reading it feeling like I understood.
Well, what they usually
they
give the whole formula at the beginning and the end, and the dots are just in the middle when it's being repeated.
Yeah, but they said there are four nutriments, and then they didn't list four.
Oh, okay.
And so I was trying to figure out what all they were talking about.
Okay.
So I was confused.
Yeah, we'll get into those next time.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll look for that. All right, well, thank you for your kind attention. And I'm really excited about embarking on this journey with all of you. I think it's going to be very rich. And but don't take my word for it. Figure it out for yourself. And we will do our best to make alternate translations and things like that available for those of you that don't have access to the book or for whatever reason. For those of you that do want to order the book that weren't able to do so, you can get it for about the same price from Amazon or your favorite online bookseller or your favorite brick and mortar bookseller. Let's keep them going too. So in a world that sometimes isn't even aware of the depth of its suffering, and in a world where many, many, many others are suffering greatly and quite aware of it, let's dedicate any good energy, any positive energy, the welfare and happiness that we've experienced by practicing together, and the influence that we've had on others by practicing skillfully, dedicate that to relieving the suffering of all beings. May all beings truly be free from suffering in this lifetime. Thank you for your practice.